Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here. It's April already, episode number 155 of this fine podcast that we do each and every week to bring you some great ideas when it comes to investing. And this week is no exception. I think we have a wonderful guest. His name is Rob Parento. He's with Agora Financial, writes a great newsletter. We're going to talk about things related to Greece. He wrote a recent article that I thought was just amazing, and he has a great deal of information when it comes to worldwide global economics. And we're going to bring him on in a second, and we'll start talking about some of the things, hopefully, that I need some answers to, like as in the word of the month, which is rhetoric. The amount of rhetoric that has been going through the system these days is unbelievable when it comes to the Greece debt and what's going to happen between Germany and France and the rest of the European region. Other than that, I want to talk about some of the things that have gone on. Boy, we have seen some massive turnarounds. Last week, we talked about that we saw a signal in the banking sector that was a what we call a gravestone doji, where you see this very long wick, but a very, very small area on the bottom. In other words, the market action during a day, week, whatever time period that you're looking at, shows a move up higher, but then slams down and close on the low for the day. Kind of looks like a gravestone. And you think about it for a moment, what we saw in the banking sector last week was a little bit tough. The banks didn't do so well. There was a lot of concern about the profitability and what would be happening with the new Volcker rule. But we also saw some very interesting things happen in the area of the oil and gas services. And not to mention the fact that oil popped over $85 a barrel. Boy, are we having a bit of deja vu here or what? One of the things I thought was really interesting was this. Did you notice this? Have you noticed this? It's like opposite day. If, in fact, President Obama and the rest of the crew say something to the effect of, we're going to really attack the financial sector, the guys that really were bringing us down with the exorbitant bonuses and all the problems they have with their trading and their deceit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what should happen? Well, you'd think that the banks would start to slow down a bit and really take a little pause. But no, banks go right up after Volcker talks and talks about the Volcker rule because, of course, any financial regulation reform is going to be put on the back burner now. Same thing happened, if you think about it, with the healthcare stocks. We saw that there was this attack going to be made on the insurance companies, the HMOs, et cetera. And wouldn't you know it, those things did quite well after the announcement of the healthcare reform really came to pass. And then on top of that, we saw that President Obama came out with the drill, drill, drill philosophy this week, where we're going to allow for offshore drilling in areas that weren't allowed before. And wouldn't you know it, well, we did see, of course, a nice pop to some of the oil services and the rig builders, Diamond Offshore, Atwood Oceanics, etc. But at the same time, when he talked about a new CAFE standards for when it came to cars and emissions, and when it came to the requirement for about a 36 mile per gallon minimum on cars, and we talked about how we had to be less dependent on oil, not only foreign oil, but oil overall, and how we're spending too much money on oil, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You would think that would have hurt oil, right? Well, nope. It popped oil right through the roof, even after an inventory number that came out that was pretty abysmal. So what does that mean? I don't know, but it almost seems like whatever President Obama does, we should consider what would be the areas that would be hit the hardest and invest in them anyway. I mean, that sounds crazy, but that's really kind of what has gone on. And I think that when we look at the markets right now, we realize the amount of money that's been pumped into it and the rhetoric that goes on throughout Europe, and that the euro is finally rising up versus the dollar because everybody thinks that the situation is under control there. We did see some great things happen out of China. We saw the Tonkin survey out of Japan do very well last week, and there was some mixed numbers on the economic front. But overall, we're seeing some okay numbers out of many of the companies, and the analysts are upping their expectations. Moreover, we saw some negative issues. We saw Research in Motion come out with a pretty ugly-looking quarter, which has been the case every single time over the last number of quarters when they come out with the number. Stock drifts down under 70, maybe even close to 60, and then drives up into the next quarter. Everybody gets all excited on the prospects of what's going to happen. This is kind of what we've been seeing for individual positions, but the overall market has been kind of steady and doing quite well. As a matter of fact, they're reaching the upper part of where it has kind of reached some resistance at this point. You know, of course, that doesn't mean that it's going to stop at this point. There's a lot of momentum going in, a lot of buy in the dip mentality, a lot of people that think that, you know, everybody will be saved at this point. So that's a good thing. But I'd caution you that we need to be aware of the next few weeks in between now and earnings season as one of those times that is kind of like there's not a lot going on, questioning how much, new federal initiatives will be announced. And question, you know, what's going to happen? Is there going to be a squaring up of positions over from, you know, the time now till then? And at the same time, we have to wonder what would be the result if we saw things like many countries that are considering increasing their interest rates. Matter of fact, we're writing a piece on inflation right now. And this is something that we need to kind of consider. You know, where is that all play out? How does that play out for our investments? I don't think it's time to kind of rest on your laurels right now, but it's a time to, you know, definitely take a look at the strongest positions. We are actually firming up some of our portfolios. We have a partial hedge on our portfolio now, which has been making money and not making money and making money and not making money of late because we've seen these markets kind of go up, then slam down, and then come back up. And we are short in a modest way right now in our portfolios, but not too much to fight the tape. But nonetheless, not making a lot of progress over the last couple of weeks or so because of it. In the meantime, I thought what we'd do is we'd give you the opportunity to spend a little time when I want to have the time, actually, talking to Rob Parento over from Agora. And I think the thing that we really need to ask him and really I need to focus on is this whole idea of you know, what is the result of this Greece debacle? And I think that's the first thing we'll actually talk to him about. And that's the first question I'll ask him. You know, it really is something that I think we all need to understand a little bit more. And for a long time, we've been talking about Greece and the whole issue around what's going with the euro and the comparison with the dollar and what's happening in the pigs and the fibs and all these different countries throughout the European zone, not to mention Eastern European bloc, et cetera. And I read an interesting article about this, and I thought that we would actually talk a bit more about this with someone who's an expert, not just me blathering about this. His name is Rob Parento, and he's with Agora Financial. He writes the Arisha Basher letter. It's a newsletter that I think you'll find very interesting if you do check it out. But let's get into this. Rob, tell me, what is the story? First of all, hello, how are you?
Hi, good, thank you. Good
talk. Now, tell me, what is the deal with Greece? Because what I have been blathering about is this whole idea that this is nothing more than a gigantic confidence game looking to looked at by, let's primarily say, Germany and France in order to get the confidence of people so that we will pay off the debt of Greece and roll it forward for them for another number of years. So they kick the can down the street sometime in the future. But at the same time, we're being told this whole ridiculous commentary that, you know, they're going to be able to bring their deficit to GDP and their payments down to some exorbitantly low level compared to what they are in a matter of years. So there's my spiel on it. Tell me how off I am or how right I am or whatever's going on there.
No, you've got a lot of the moving parts in hand already, and I'm going to throw a couple of more feedback loops into that story that you were just telling because I think it gets us to the heart of the issue. And my point of view here is that there are a number of countries, including Greece, in the peripheral Eurozone countries that have run up very large fiscal deficits as a share of GDP over the last 2-3 years now. They had severe recessions, and what happens to your fiscal balance during a severe recession? The tax revenues all dry up, and the unemployment compensation goes up. And so we're now looking at a number of countries that have 10, 11, 12% fiscal deficits as a share of GDP. That's huge. And these countries were supposed to stay within a band close to 2, 3, 4% of GDP, according to some of the documents that they signed to get into the Eurozone. So this is a huge violation of the supposed agreement that they all had amongst each other. Now, the issue for Greece and for a number of these countries is when you get out to a 10, 11, 12% of GDP fiscal debt, fiscal deficit as a share of GDP, you have to issue a lot of public debt. And your bond buyers look at you sideways and say, are you going to be able to pay that back over time? Because that's a pretty big load that you're taking on, both in terms of interest expense and servicing the debt and the principal over time. So about 2-3 months ago, after we had a little bit of trouble in Dubai with some debt getting rolled over, people looked around the world and they said, hey, where else could there be another problem? And they landed in the Eurozone, and they landed on Greece in particular. And they, I think, basically took a step back and said, well, you're going to have to pay us a much higher premium, a much higher interest rate, if you want us to continue to play this game, if you want us to continue to buy your debt. Now, what's the larger structure here? I think the larger issue here is we've got a bunch of countries that got together in a common currency, and they found out that there were two countries that seemed to be more competitive than the others that were involved in the common currency. That would be Germany, and that would be the Netherlands. Both of those countries run huge trade surpluses with the rest of the region, which means they're selling more exports than they're buying imports from the other countries in the region. A lot of the peripheral countries ended up in just the opposite condition. They were importing a lot more from Greece and the Netherlands, and they weren't able to export that much. So not only did these countries have huge fiscal deficits as a share of GDP, they also have these large trade deficits as well. And that means a lot of this debt, this public debt, ended up in foreign hands, in foreign investor hands. So something like 70% of the Greek debt is in foreign hands. So when they pay interest expense on that public debt, guess where it goes? It ends up in the pockets of the Germans and the Dutch, and there's also some in the French economy as well that benefit from these interest payments. And so now we've got a standoff between the core countries, Germany and the Netherlands in particular, that have run these current account surpluses with the rest of the region, and these peripheral countries that are running these huge budget deficits and have been relying on the foreign savers to continue to bail them out. And the foreign savers have said, no, we're not going to do it. Now, this gets very complicated because as these countries were running these huge current account surpluses, they ended up lending some of the money back to the private sectors, too, in the Eurozone area. So the household and the business sectors in Greece, in Italy, in Portugal, in Spain, borrowed money from the banks in France and Germany and the Netherlands and so on. What's going to happen now as these countries are forced to reduce their fiscal balances, reduce their fiscal deficits on a very quick timeline? We're talking over the next year, Greece having signed up for reducing its fiscal deficit by 4% of GDP. That is a tough thing to do. That takes a lot of tax hikes and takes a lot of expenditure cutting. So who bears the brunt of that? Well, the households and the businesses that have to pay the higher taxes and no longer benefit as much from government spending because that's being cut back, it's their income flows, it's their cash flows that will be impacted. So what's going to happen to the private sectors of these Eurozone periphery countries that are cutting back their fiscal deficits very rapidly? They're going to get screwed down tight. They're going to be finding more and more households experiencing debt distress and inability to service their existing debt load, and more companies going bankrupt or being delinquent and servicing their debt. That backs right up into the system. It backs right up into the German banks. It backs right up into the Netherlands banks. And so what's really going on here is the core country banks need to be bailed out backhandedly. And they're trying to find mechanisms to make sure the public deficits still get placed in the debt markets smoothly and cleanly, and they're not quite sure how to do that because nobody wants to write the check, nobody wants to do the fiscal assistance, especially the German taxpayers, to make that all happen. So it's a really big mess, but at the end of the day, it looks like the core countries have figured out if they're going to try and screw down the fiscal deficits, get the fiscal deficits back in line, then there's a little problem here. It's going to back up through the system, is going to show up on their bank balance sheets, and they're going to be writing off a big chunk of their capital. And we just went through that in the last couple of years with these deep recessions. They don't want to have to go through that again. So they're trying to find some sort of adjustment mechanism that will work, and politically, there's not a whole hell of a lot that looks like it's going to fly
But Rob, listen, let's face facts. Nobody cares.
That's part of it.
Nobody cares.
But the thing is that they're discovering that they're all in the same boat, right? It's their banks that are going to go down, and it's also their exporters that are going to lose markets as the peripheral countries begin to pull in and tighten their belts. And so this is going to feed back to these guys through their banking system and through their trading companies that depend upon being able to make sales to Italy, to Greece, and Ireland, and so forth. So,
let me say this again. Nobody cares. And am I wrong? Nobody cares. They just keep on running the banks up, and like there's nothing, never a problem. Like there's an unlimited amount of money that will be, you know, washed on. And that this is the problem. The moral hazard that has been put upon this market, particularly we're talking about the European market, that has been, it's this concerted effort on a global basis of nonstop rhetoric and of testing out market conditions verbally and then backing off and doing something differently if a market, whether it's a debt market or it's an equity market, doesn't like it, is this continual process that nobody knows what's going on, but everybody keeps throwing money at it.
Yeah, the assumption is at the end of the day, this is a huge game of eyeball-to-eyeball brinksmanship, right?
Yep.
And at the end of the game, you know who's going to flinch first. Your government is going to flinch first, or your central banker is going to flinch first, and they're going to write the check, or they're going to create the money to put a floor on falling asset prices one way or another, and a floor on incomes one way or another. Everybody knows this. This is the game that's been played over and over in spades in the last two or three years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're getting to that point, though, where this is too obvious to too many people, and in particular, the people in Germany are not willing to write that check for the people in Greece anymore.
So what they do is they issue a massive amount of debt under the German name, under the German AAA rating, if you will. What do? They buy the Greek debt. They're going to be responsible for it anyway. They get a 4% arbitrage on the deal, and everybody's happy.
Well, that's what they're trying to figure out. Is there a backdoor mechanism that they can create that will allow them to somehow continue to float this public debt, maybe not as much as they were originally anticipating because the fiscal deficits will have to be screwed down somehow, but they will still get placed because there'll be some sort of mechanism like a European Monetary Fund or maybe the IMF will get in there and they'll either do some sort of guarantees or they'll do the actual purchases themselves and repackage the damn stuff with some sort of guarantee on it to try and get it placed.
So now we're going to have securitized government debt.
It looks like that's the way the conversation
nice.
Is going,
nice.
As if they're going to find some way of pooling money through this supranational organization of some sort. And what's not clear is how they're going to finance that themselves. Will they just issue debt on that themselves and that gets placed? Or are they all going to have to cough up something from their own tax revenues? Or is there some weird way they're going to try and have the ECB create money out of thin air and fund the whole thing?
Which would not
be unusual.
I'll
tell you, one of the things that we've noticed that has gone on here, and it's not just Greece, it's also evident in Ireland, is there's sort of a backdoor monetization that's been going on. The Greek government will sell its public bonds to the Greek banks. The Greek banks can create money out of thin air. They don't need to have savings in the pool to be able to buy that. They just, basically need to have reserves in place.
Mm-hmm.
And they then turn around and they do something called a repo with the ECB. They sell or basically rent the Greek government bonds to the ECB. And in turn, they get a reload on reserves so they can go out and buy more Greek government bonds. Well, this is basically a backdoor monetization, and that was not supposed to be designed into the original European Central Bank. The Eurozone Central Bank was not supposed to be like that. It was supposed to be pretty hardcore like the Bundesbank. So, these guys are finding whatever way they possibly can to, inch their way around the rules. And no doubt, something like a Eurozone Monetary Fund or something of that sort is going to come out of this horrible mess.
Well, and the other thing that's really, I guess, the most troubling about this is, and again, from the aspect of nobody cares, is that when this was set up, it was supposed to require countries to have a very strict line in terms of their budget and all that, and their deficit. And the only reason why this came to pass recently was because it was brought to bear by a lot of, they would call it the, they say the traitors, and causing all sorts of problem for the euro, and the governments got pissed off that the euro was starting to lose value at such a rapid clip. And to be honest with you, I'm trying to scratch my head wondering, why wasn't it the eurozone and the European leaders that called attention to this thing prior, when they were well outside, when Greece in particular, and there was other countries too, but Greece was so well outside the boundaries of what their required financials were supposed to look like? Why was it that it had to be brought to the attention, and basically they were in protection zone, and they're all about, you know, making sure that that the euro wasn't going to go down, rather than doing what they said they were going to do? I mean, I know that sounds a little bit, you know, kind of Pollyanna and a little bit, you know, kind of fantasy land there, but I mean, am I wrong? They would have never said anything if it wasn't brought up and it wasn't pushed on them.
You know, I think it's just their way of doing business, but this is a very good point that you bring up. They did have something called the Stability and Growth Pact, and you were supposed to, again, as I said before, stay within a certain fiscal deficit to GDP ratio. Around 3% was where they were shooting. And if you didn't stay there, you got fined big time. But this was a soft constraint at best, and how are you going to fine governments that were already in lots of trouble with huge fiscal deficits? Anyway, I mean, this was not a well-thought-out mechanism if it was going to actually work from the get-go. And so now we have the actual implementation of this thing, and we're finding out they're not really playing by the rules they said they were going to play by.
Right.
So if you went in there and you bought, you know, government bonds from any of these countries sometime in the last 3 years, thinking that that 3% of GDP fiscal deficit was going to be a hard and fast rule and that people would be reined in as soon as they broke through that rule, it's been a completely different story than that, hasn't it?
Yeah. Do you think that, I guess the question then is, well, two questions. Do you think that the austerity measures and all the things that Greece is doing is actually going to work for them?
This is the paradox. What happens when they start to crank up the taxes and cut back the expenditures is the private sector, initially at least, and often for a long time, goes through a bit of an implosion. Because as I said before, what are you doing? You're sucking income out of the private sector, out of the households and businesses when you raise taxes on them. And when you cut expenditures, programs that may be supporting the unemployed income and so forth, again, you're cutting the cash flow to the private sector. So that means after you get done with your draconian cuts in expenditures and your big tax hikes, the private sector goes into freefall, it goes into recession, and private income levels can actually fall. You can get income deflation occurring amongst households and businesses in the private sector. So what does that happen? What happens in the next round? What happens in the next period when they go to collect taxes? All of a sudden they discover, household incomes aren't as high as we thought they were going to be, and businesses aren't reporting as high profits as they thought they would, so we're coming up a little light on the tax revenues. And looks like we're going to miss that fiscal target that we promised you guys, you bond investors and you policymakers, that we would hit one way or another. This is a real problem, and it's already occurred in Ireland to some extent. I think we're next going to see it in Greece. They have a huge refinancing wave that they need to complete with their public debt, and a huge placement of public debt they need to do in the next couple of months. They may be able to fudge their way through the next couple of months,
right?
But my guess is they're going to get into this little debt trap dynamic that I just described for you, where they find out, hey, they just drove their private sectors into the ground. There's no way in hell they're going to collect the taxes they thought they were going to collect.
Yeah, I think whether or not they have any bond issuance or not, just doing what they're doing with these austerity and budget measures is going to be enough to cause them a lot of problems. But again, I end this little clip right here with you with, but nobody cares.
Yeah, well, the investors care to some extent because we have seen the bond spreads widen. But the investors have concluded there won't be a default yet.
Right.
There, I think, is a strong possibility the end game to all of this will be default. We could very well see that occur. But at the moment, there's going to be too much shuttling between policymakers, and these crazy things like the EMF will be put together in the meantime. But I think it's going to become apparent in the next 2, 3, possibly 4 months that by putting these austerity measures in place, you're driving your economies into the ground, and it's going to make it even harder to meet your fiscal targets. And when the bond investors figure that one out, they're not going to be happy.
Yeah.
When the investors in banks in the eurozone that have lent money to the private sectors in the periphery find out that the loan losses are going up on mortgages and corporate loans to that part of the world, they're not going to want to own those equities.
But it seems to me that this is going to be some time before this reality sits in.
This is a story that I think probably really begins to catch a lot of traction early to midsummer. You've got time still to set up and position and monitor for this. I agree with you entirely.
What's the story, in your opinion, with the euro? The euro has seen a dramatic move, both up and down recently. It seems that the once the all clear signal is sung that the Greece is going to be fine, that they get some IMF backing or whatever else is going on, that all of a sudden it shoots up. It really rocketed up this week, which is really interesting because one of the things that happened that is the negative side of all this is that the oil prices have stayed very, very stable in the 78 to 82 range or so for a while. And now that all of a sudden we're seeing a real weakening of the dollar, particularly against the euro and other currencies due to some strength issues in the U.S. and also due to the fact that all of a sudden, hey, everything's fine in Greece and all that, oil pops above 85. Again, I can't figure out how much more we have to go on the upside with oil before we start seeing a real effect to the U.S. economy. Every few cents costs a lot of money when it comes to the overall cost of things. And obviously, we're still seeing the need for the need for people to have more money so they can buy more and build this economy. But I mean, what's the outlook for the euro with all this?
So. Yeah, you're right about the oil prices. Just like with taxes, when the oil prices go up, money gets sucked out of the oil consumers and it goes to the oil producers. So that doesn't help the situation one bit, does it?
No.
With regard to the private sector and the peripheral Eurozone countries that are already going to be facing fiscal austerity. The last thing that they need is higher oil prices staring them in the face, sucking more income out of the private sectors there as well. So that is certainly a complicating factor and doesn't make it any easier for these economies to right themselves. My own feeling is that the euro will, after this initial bounce that you have described, and it looks like it has begun, and probably is good for a month or two at best, I think there's another 15, 20, maybe 25% down leg on the euro, and here's why. I think the only way these guys are going to get out of their problem is try to export their way out of their problem. The Eurozone as a whole has historically, in the last 10 years, run a small current account or trade surplus, close to 1% of GDP. That's now close to minus 1% of GDP. The only way the corporate, household, and government sectors of these countries can all improve their cash flows is to figure out how to sell goods and services to the rest of the world somehow. Now, you can do innovation. You can cut your costs. But if you bring your currency down, that's usually a fairly quick route to getting higher market share in global marketplaces.
And which is what Japan just did this year.
Yeah.
The Japanese yen was climbing. Remember that? And then they crushed it.
So these guys eventually, I think, are going to figure out that, one, they need a much lower euro. And certainly the inflation within the Eurozone should be coming down as the fiscal austerity takes root and knocks the private sectors back a few notches. And I think the other part of the story here on the euro is that private investors, as they figure out the fiscal austerity is driving these economies back into another recession, they just barely have come out of the last recession, and they figure out the fiscal austerity in the periphery is backing up into the banking systems of the core and backing up in the form of lower export sales by the companies in the core, they're not going to want to own those equities. And as they figure out that the economies are being driven down into the ground and they're not going to hit the fiscal targets because they're not going to get the tax revenues they thought they were going to get, they're not going to want to own those bonds either, and the prospects of defaults or huge debt renegotiations will be on the table again. In that case, private investors are going to say, you couldn't pay me enough to own those assets that currency.
Yeah, yeah.
I want out. And that's how you can get these maxi devaluations or maxi depreciations, which I think will not only end up being what the private investors will request of the zone, but what the policymakers themselves within the zone will figure out, hey, that's our only way out.
So where's the money go?
Well, the first run is usually, as we saw last time around, into where you perceive safety to be. So we may get money flowing back into the U.S. and money flowing back into the U.S. treasuries. I also think both the U.S. and the Asian, more specifically the Asian countries, have shown a good recovery profile. China seems to have been an engine of growth for its region, and we're probably, if not this month, next month, staring at positive payroll gains. And I think it's a good, there's a good chance that money would come out of European equities and go mostly to U.S. equities, but also into Asian equities as well. So I think that's where the equity money would flow. I think the fixed income money would flow to safety. It would go back to U.S.
So why, if everybody knows all these problems that are being seen, and it seems pretty apparent, and the market is a generally a forward-looking instrument, why is it that there seems to be no problem with many of the European equity markets? In particular, we know that, for example, that England is having massive
problems. Exactly the point that you brought up early on, which is everybody assumes the fix is in. The policymakers will find something, they'll put the fix in, they always do it, they'll do it again this time. I remember people in the hedge fund world that were getting into backing up asset-backed securities and CDO structures in 2007, 2008, because they knew the fix would be in. Well, guess what? They got their butts handed to them, and lots of them are out of jobs these days. So you're absolutely right. Almost every professional investor has been trained, once they identify a problem spot or a potential crisis, to immediately assume the policy fix will be in and it will do the trick. In this case, the policy fix we're talking about, fiscal austerity, ain't going to do the trick. It's going to do just the opposite, and people don't understand that yet. I'm quite sure this story is only just beginning to sink in. Only in the last week have I been able to find anybody talking about this banking feedback loop and actually put some numbers to it. When I talk to people in London that are in the hedge fund world, and I say, so which German banks are you shorting? Which French banks are you shorting? They say, why would we want to do that?
Right.
They don't understand this loop yet. But it's obvious if you think it through, this is how it's likely to play out.
And how much exposure do the U.S. banks have with that, with any of this?
Not very much at all. It's very minimal. Most of the cross-border financial claims are on German and French banks. And as a share of GDP, the Irish banks, believe it or not, have a large exposure as well.
Which isn't very good. So you write about a variety of other things. What are the topics you're covering these days?
I did a piece on hyperinflation, trying to figure out what are the prospects of countries that are now running large fiscal deficits and also having expanded central bank balance sheets quite dramatically. What are the prospects of things flying off in a hyperinflationary dynamic? And this is a big headache, because if you're a retired person or you're on any kind of fixed income, if inflation starts to accelerate, you're basically going to end up eating cat food or dog food, and that's not generally a good thing.
Right.
So I went back, I looked at the Weimar Republic, I looked at the Zimbabwe situation, I looked at some of the large Latin American hyperinflations, and I tried to figure out what were the common ingredients, and one of them is indeed large and rising fiscal deficits, but there's much more to the story than that, and it seems like you need to have... you've got to have labor contracts with cost of living adjustments in them so that they ratchet up wages along with prices, or you've got to have very loosey-goosey credit markets so households can get access to credit, because without either of those two things, if prices take off and household incomes don't take off too, guess what? They can't afford the goods and services.
Right, so it just keeps puts a bit of a ceiling.
So it blows itself out. Yeah, it's like a flame that flames out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you need a specific set of circumstances to get a hyperinflation going. The other thing that seemed to be common and not very well analyzed is that you need supply shocks. So you need entrepreneurs going to work and saying, now wait a minute, if I go buy things that are not easily produced, there's not much of a supply of them around, or you can't increase the supply very much. So I'm talking gold, I'm talking silver, I'm talking old master paintings, I'm talking Chinese ceramics, I'm talking farmland, all the stuff that people were trying to get their hands on in the 1970s when we had stagflation. That entrepreneur says, I can take the capital I've got invested in my business, put it into those things, and make a lot more money and not have to worry about the headache of producing things in an environment where prices and costs, they're just going crazy, and I don't know what's going to be like tomorrow. So you need the entrepreneurs basically to walk away from production, or you need something like in the Weimar Republic, the French to come in and take over a whole part of your industrial producing economy, the Ruhr Valley, and basically take that production away from you. So you're looking for situations where there's a supply constraint or supply shock that arises too. When you see those three ingredients, fiscal deficits, a cost of living adjustment, and a supply shock or supply diminishment, then you can get a hyperinflation. We have one of those three. I don't think we're going to get the other two. But you better keep your eyes open for them because you don't want to live through hyperinflation.
Well, let's talk about just inflation for a minute, because I'm actually writing a piece right now in our quarterly market commentary or economic commentary and review about inflation. Is inflation here? Is it anywhere to be found? I mean, aside from Venezuela, aside from, as you mentioned, Zimbabwe, and a few other core places that it may, you know, show up. I mean, it looks like from every analyst that I can see and every outlook I can see over the next 2 years, let's say, that we have a basic, not a deflationary, but a disinflationary environment that's going on. But at the same time, what's really fascinating to me is that, you know, we are looking at, you know, manufacturing that is moving up. We're looking at the prices of materials moving up. Not naturally, oil and energy prices are moving up. Food prices have been pretty stagnant and all. But, you know, it's interesting because all the ingredients that are going into much of this seem to signal that we should have a not maybe inflationary, but not a disinflationary environment. And the question is, how is that possible?
Yeah, well, I would, first of all, before you send that piece around, I want you to go take a look at China and India and some of the other Asian countries where we do have signs that inflation is starting to heat up.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you look at in India, the wholesale price index, or in China, the consumer price index, some of this is related to supply shocks on the food side in particular. But in the case of China, there's now some indications there may be, believe it or not, labor shortages showing up, at least along the coastal regions. They've also pushed up minimum wages recently. And a lot of their fiscal stimulus was designed to go to the interior regions. And so the workers from those regions are staying in those regions and benefiting from that fiscal stimulus as opposed to going to the coastal regions. So there's some evidence of labor and food-driven inflation starting to show up in China as well. So I would simply suggest there may be pockets of inflation showing up in some of the Asian countries that you want to keep an eye on.
And the commodity-based companies too. I mean, Australia as well. You know,
So add a paragraph or two in your piece about that, because I think it is important to flag that, because these are the fastest growing regions, and if they have to go slam on the policy brakes sooner than everybody thinks, and certainly that is a concern with China, India as well is starting to follow in their footsteps of tightening monetary policy. If those are the fastest growing parts of the world and inflation's heating up sooner than people expected, and the policymakers have to throw on the brakes, well, what does that mean for the engines of growth in the region and possibly the globe as well? So that's one of the side worries, I think, especially of global equity investors. But with regard to the supply and materials price increases that we're seeing, iron ore the other day, as you mentioned before, energy consistently has gone up over the last year. These are inputs into durable goods, into consumer durable goods, into big ticket items. And if you can't pass that through to your final consumer because, guess what, their pay package isn't going up, or they can't take a home equity loan out of their house anymore, or they're cutting up their credit cards, then you get caught in a profit squeeze if the materials are a big enough chunk of your cost of production. Now, you just got to go down through the line items and check that out company by company. What we're seeing so far is that's not the problem, because the U.S. companies have been very aggressive and squeezing just an enormous improvement in labor productivity. They're not hiring anybody in, yet their sales and production units are going up. And they've screwed down compensation growth pretty tightly as well. So unit labor costs are actually deflating. They're falling on a year-over-year basis. They're falling faster than I can find in any time in the last 50 or 60 years.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, productivity is up. I mean, this is the classic, right? Productivity up, unit labor costs down. I mean, you just look at that, too. And capacity utilization, right, at a kind of a not the highest level. It was about 70 or something like that. Not the highest point, but in the U.S. But here's the sweetness of it. You know, the fact is that if you can keep that going, if you can keep your unit labor costs generally down or not rising too much, if you can keep your productivity somewhat even or at least on a relatively basis, not falling off from here, then what is the point of hiring? Now, that brings us to the next point. Now, obviously, if there's a need to, you will, if there's a dramatic demand. But then you get into the problem is, well, where's the demand coming from if you don't have a lot more employment? So we'll see temporary demand coming in from fiscal stimulus. We'll see from a variety of different measures that the U.S. government takes, et cetera. And now we're seeing the potential for a positive print on, you know, of the next number of months because of the census, you know. So the thing is that, you know, the one thing I question is, you know, looking down the road 6 months from now, 7 months from now in the U.S., considering the fact that many of the regions outside the U.S. and China, as you mentioned, and a few others that are seeing potential for a cutting down of their making sure that they don't overheat at all, and there's a lot of signs of that going on. What do we see for the U.S.? Are we out of the woods here entirely? Is it kind of like smooth sailing, generally speaking? I'm not talking about straight shot up. I mean, you know, not going down for a major double dip here. I mean, where are we in your thoughts on the economy from this point forward?
On the U.S. side, the way I read it after the Fed came out almost a year ago, March of last year, shortly after in the U.K., the Bank of England came out and said, we're going to do something we call quantitative easing. And that involves us creating money out of thin air and going out and buying assets that are held by the private sector in their portfolios. And in this case, it's going to be government debt that we buy or GSE or agency debt that we buy. And we're going to do it to the tune of $1 trillion or more. When I saw that, again, going back to our earlier conversation, to me, was the all-in signal. It's the Fed's putting all their chips on the table. Everything they had tried up to that point had not really gotten equity investors' attention. At least they weren't believing it. Equity prices were still soggy going into early March. Nothing they had tried had worked, and they went all in. And at that point, I said, okay, I know how this works. I saw this in 1998. I've seen it time and time again. There is a tipping point, and there's a game of poker that's played out there. And these guys have just given the signal that the ultimate moral hazard is on the table, and they'll do whatever it takes.
Right.
So that you put that together with the fiscal stimulus, which was of a size I had never seen before in my adult life, I figured the policy push would eventually work, but it was going to be touch and go there for a few months. So by the summer of last year, I could find enough stuff starting to turn around and begin to stabilize that I felt the right way to go was with a shallow recovery call and with a 2010 expansion call. And I still think we'll track something close to 3.5-4% real GDP this year. How are we going to do that? One, massive fiscal policy. Two, the labor productivity that you were mentioning before. We're getting really good export growth off of that, so we're stealing market share from the rest of the world. And we're also appearing to be able to create new markets with new products along the way here. The third sleeper, and this is one that I don't think is very well appreciated yet, is orders on non-defense capital goods have picked up quite dramatically over the last year. It took 4 years to do the pickup that we've just done in 1 year. Why would that be the case? We've got such low capacity utilization rates out there. Well, look at profits. Corporate profit margins have regained half of the decline from peak to trough that they did in the last recession. That's on a really weak GDP number. There's huge operating leverage out there because, as you said, they've cut labor to the bone. They're working everybody overtime, and that's what you get. All the top line goes right to the bottom line in that kind of situation. And so I think we've got a capital goods cycle kicking in here. When I look at the net investment of non-residential equipment, that's plant and equipment, that the companies use as a share of GDP, I've never seen it so low. It got rock bottom low. That means there's got to be replacement cycles out there that are kicking in. It also means if you survive the recession, guess what? You want to be top dog coming out. You're going to put the thing that's going to get you the most innovative products out there or get you the lowest cost production out there. You're going to go and reinvest some of that free cash flow, which is huge now on the corporate side, back into that tangible plant and equipment be in that competitive position as you come out of this thing. So I think there's a capital spending leg to this that's just beginning to become more and more visible to people. Industrials have had a good run year to date in equity sectors. I think people are getting on to this, but the economists haven't figured it out yet. The equity investors are figuring it out slowly but surely. Now, if you can do that with a consumer that's still delivering 1.5-2% real personal consumption growth, which is about where we've been the last couple quarters, you can actually get to 3.5-4% GDP, especially if you've got to rebuild inventories And that has only just begun in the last few months here. So I think you put that picture together, and we may be surprised at the strength that we get out of this thing, even with households still trying to repair their balance sheet.
Well, actually, you know, the interesting thing is that if you do see a pickup in spending of any sort here, for whatever the reason is, you know, and you have such a thinly or well-designed, I should say, but a thin expense load on that necessarily, say, or what I say should say is a better profit margin. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, therefore, what happens there is that you get some real upshot. The question, though, is, and I really do have this question, you know, when does it come time that the analysts who have been terribly wrong, by the way, I don't know what your opinion is, but generally speaking, the equity analysts have been god awful with their predictions on numbers from.
I'll take a credit analyst any day over an equity analyst.
There's no question about that. There's no question about that. And that's why you want to sometimes look at the CDS exposure and the pricing of a stock versus,
yes,
you know, versus
exactly.
The actual numbers internally. But they've been absolutely abysmal. It's almost like they want to be short right now because they don't want to get caught with their pants down. But many analysts are getting a lot more excited about what's going on. And that is, you know, I wonder if that's going to have any kind of effect. We've seen a few stocks here, and actually last quarter, even though markets were up, fourth quarter I'm talking about, you know, moved up nicely, you know, there was a lot of stocks that got whacked over the head when the earnings came out. Because there was
this is another dimension. You can have the macro picture dialed in 100% perfect. You may have the perfect crystal ball. But if you don't step back and figure out, well, what has the market already discounted? What is the sentiment setup? What is the technical setup? Is everybody all in already? Have they put all their cash to work already? If you don't step back and do that next part of the analysis, I don't care how good your macro forecasting is, you're not going to make money with that.
Right.
But you're right. You've got to step back and take a look at that dimension. Now, I don't know how to read charts. I don't know how people do it. I consider it something like a Ouija board or along those lines, reading the tea leaves, but people do it, and there's a lot of very short-term traders, as you know, in this market that live and die by that type of analysis. So I think the best thing to do is to step back and have a grab bag of sentiment indicators that you look at and technical indicators that you look at. I like the Ned Davis Crowd Sentiment Index. I know a lot of other people look at that, and that's one of those grab bags. But there's other tools out there as well that are available to the general public.
Yeah, and right now they're all saying it's a big bullish party, and buying all the dips, and, you know, if something goes down, that's reason to buy, and that may be the case, by the way, but, you know, it's almost like, and nothing will fail. You got to put that into the picture, into the party, as you're talking about, and that's kind of where the sentiment is at right now. It's very interesting how quickly sentiment changes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and the thing that I think we both, and I'm sure you've been around markets long enough to appreciate it, but the slingshot effect coming out of the lows of March of last year was just a rip-your-face-off kind of event.
Yep.
If you were on the short or bear side of the equation,
absolutely,
you got your head handed to you. Well, how soon are you going to be willing to wade back into that market and begin shorting any kind of stocks after you've just lived through that experience?
Yeah, we've been very...
You've got the capital to do it, never mind. It's
very difficult. You know what? Right now, the game is, if you can make 3 or 4% on a short, move on.
Yeah, that's right. You take your profits and don't just sit there naked and get wiped out, because that can happen to you. So people who were of that predisposition, they got their heads handed to them, they're going to be a little gun-shy about coming back in. What we do seem to have here is from November on, kind of a creeping sideways to slightly upward direction in the equity market. I think for exactly the reason that you mentioned, everybody got all in so quickly on the professional or institutional side of the business, not the retail side of the business. The individual investor said, Whoa, wait a minute. I didn't want to go through this twice in one decade.
Right.
You just put me through the ringer twice, and I'm about to retire. I'm going into bonds. I'm going into bond funds. Take me out of equities. And I can't sit around in money market funds because I'm getting nothing on that.
Right.
So there's a split mindset out there that you have to be careful with. But the professional guys, the institutional guys, went all in. They couldn't afford to miss the rally. They would have been out of jobs if they did. So they put a pedal to the metal very quickly. They put cash to work very quickly. By November, they're all looking around each other around the table. They've got no more cash to put to work, and the valuations are looking a little steeper, and they're not so sure the earnings are going to come through. And then even when the earnings did come through, as you mentioned, for Q4 and beat expectations, it was a ho-hum because everybody had already put everything on the table on the institutional side.
Right, so, and now we're looking at the commitment of traders actually getting a little bit short here. which is really interesting. In other words, the professionals are getting short, and what we're finding is the retail is getting long. Now, in the end, by the way, I think we all know this, the institutions will win out.
That tends to be the way. The folks that get fleeced are the last ones in. Sometimes it's the European, sometimes it's the retail investor. But, yeah, that's the case.
And yeah, so, we'll have to be looking out for that. So, listen, let me just tell everybody that they can grab your information. We'll put, of course, links on the show notes of this particular show. But Rob Parento, his information, he writes the Rischenbacher. That's how you say it. Tell us about it, by the way.
Rischenbacher letter, yeah.
Tell us what that where that name comes from.
Dr. Kurt Rischenbacher was trained in the late 30s in England, and then he picked up, while he was there, he picked up a lot of what was going on in the early revolution around Keynes. Then he came back to Germany, and he picked up a lot of the Austrian school orientation, which is very free market oriented, but also shares with the Keynes view an emphasis on financial markets and credit and how banks and banking systems and central banks and financial markets all have a real world, real economy impact. And this was a fellow whose work I ran into in the mid to late 90s when I was trying to figure out what's going on with this new economy bubble. What's happening with the tech telecom boom? Can that go on forever, really? Or are there imbalances, financial imbalances, beginning to build up in the system that are going to come back to haunt us?
Mm-hmm.
And Kurt was one of the few people I was reading back then that actually had the whole thing wired. He had it nailed.
Right.
He understood the dynamics that were going on between equity prices and the capital spending that was overextended in a variety of places, as we later found out, and the widening trade deficit, all these things he was talking about and linking up together in a way I could find nobody else doing. And at that time, I was working in a very large institutional money management firm. I had access to the best of the best on Wall Street. So if it was out there, I was able to see it. Kurt had it nailed in a way that nobody else really did.
That's great. And
that impressed me. I understood the framework, the analytical framework he was using. He was using unconventional tools to do the analysis, and I'll be damned if he didn't have it nailed. And then I watched him do the same thing with the housing bubble while he was alive until 2008, and he had that one nailed as well.
Hmm.
So when he passed away in 2008, I approached them and said, you know, I think this is a valuable set of tools that he's got in his toolbox, and I'd hate to see it go away. Let's see if we can take this stuff and continue to apply it in intelligent ways and get it out there to more people so that they can also do what they need to do with their portfolios to either take advantage of these situations or get the hell out of the way if something's developing adversely.
Exactly.
So we're doing that with the Eurozone. And again, I constantly am just in awe at how this guy was able to figure out the map, basically, the map that you need to understand how these macro and market dynamics interact.
So, right. Cool.
Hopefully
stuff.
We can carry on the tradition.
Cool stuff. Well, we're going to put the links on there. And, of course, I think, don't know if everybody knows this, but Agora is affiliated with Stansberry, which, of course, is our good friend Frank Curzio writes his newsletter for. So Agora Financial has just an amazing, amazing array of newsletters that are available. And I encourage everybody to check out Rob Parento's newsletter and to check out all the different Agora Financial publications that are available. And, Rob, I appreciate it. We'll stay in touch, and hopefully we'll see how this turns out in a number of months. We'll maybe come back and talk about it.
Sounds good. I appreciate your time. Good luck to you and your clients.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it. And that's all we have for today. This is Andrew Horowitz. It's the elongated weekend. Hopefully you enjoyed your time and your time off. Coming back on Monday with what we'll see what happens after the craziness we saw over the weekend, of course, and the news that we saw with regard to the euro throughout the week. And I hope that you do enjoy the next week coming up. We're into April already. Great time to be investing, hopefully, for you. And if nothing else, check out the blog at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll have all this information and much more. Until the next time, thanks for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.